And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. For 4 months now, bushfires have been raging across Australia. It's so bad that broad swaths of the country are scorched, lives and homes have been lost, and entire ecosystems are in danger of disappearing. Smoke can be seen as far away as South America, 7,000 miles across the globe. The fires are so hot that they have created thick clouds that have generated their own thunderstorms that then generate lightning that leads to more fires. The flames have also renewed the long-standing debate over climate change worldwide. We'll learn more about that and what it means for the rest of the world when we hear from a couple of environmental journalists later in the hour. But we begin with Bianca Nogrady, a writer who lives in Australia and barely escaped the flames that tore through her own neighborhood. Bianca is a science journalist whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, Nature, Scientific American, and other publications. And we should mention as well that this interview was recorded yesterday afternoon to accommodate the 16-hour time difference between Philadelphia and the part of Australia where Bianca lives. Bianca Nogrady, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tracy.
So you and your family decided to evacuate just before the flames made it to your neighborhood in Blackheath at the top of the Blue Mountains. First of all, how is your family and what happened to your home?
Well, I have to say we were very, very lucky. My family is safe. We spent five days staying in the city because, you know, I have small children and the last thing we wanted to be was in the path of a fire with kids. And the fire came within 15 metres of our house, and we have quite a large bush block, and it's scorched through the bottom half or the bottom third of that block. And we were lucky in that we had neighbours who did stay, and they worked with firefighters to make sure that the flames stayed away from the house. And they also put in containment measures, so they bulldozed what are called containment lines even around three beehives that I have on the block, so they protected those. But, I mean, we were also lucky in the timing. The fires came through the day after we had really catastrophic conditions. So the fire burned low, it burned slow, it wasn't crowning, it wasn't as terrifying as it might have been.
So you had good conditions and good neighbours, it sounded like, that saved the house.
Absolutely. I mean, we were very lucky. The whole town was lucky. I mean, the fire, Blackheath, is ringed by bush, which is why so many of us live here. And there are fingers of bush that stick up into the sort of the heart of the town, I guess. And, you know, the fire burned up many of those, and there were some pretty scary moments for people here. But it just incredibly that we lost, I think, an eco lodge, lost a few buildings. You know, people lost backyard fences and trampolines, but no houses and no lives, which, I mean, given the conditions that were forecast, given the size of this fire and the fact, well, the two fires, we were so lucky.
Indeed. So what is it like there now, not just in Blackheath where you are, but generally speaking in the country, what are conditions like right now?
Well, today, unfortunately, is forecast to be another really bad fire day. We've had a few days reprieve in that the weather's been cooler, less windy. We've even had some mist and drizzle around the country, which hasn't been enough to put these fires out because they're just so massive. It would take a sustained downpour of weeks to put these fires out, and that's not really forecast for quite some time. But we're looking today at temperatures spiking up above 100 Fahrenheit and a strong winds, and plus a wind change, which is really critical for these fires, is that often what happens is you have a strong westerly wind blowing, and then later in the evening you get a southerly, we call it the southerly buster in Sydney, but it's very, you know, comes through and it changes the direction of the fire. It's very gusty, it's very unpredictable. It makes things very difficult for firefighters on the ground. So once again, we've got a day where large parts of Australia are being told to get out, to evacuate, to just not be anywhere near the path of these fires.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of the damage so far that the country has seen in terms of, you know, casualties, the amount of land that has been burned?
I mean, it's truly staggering. And even for a nation that is used to fire, I mean, you know, our history is dotted, our modern history is dotted with, you know, catastrophic fires. Even by those scales, this is unprecedented. So we're now looking at the latest count is around 10.7 million hectares, which is about 41,000 square miles has been burned across all of Australia, but largely concentrated on the east coast. So, for example, around 5% of the entire state of Victoria has been burned. The fire that was burning to the north of us, which is happily now listed as under control, that was 500,000 hectares. We've had 26 lives lost, which is truly awful, and several of those have been firefighters. We've lost nearly 1,800 houses, and the environmental, the ecological toll is just, it's heartbreaking. I mean, there are now estimates that over a billion native animals have lost their lives, and that's not even counting things like insects and frogs and lizards. But you know, this is koalas, wallabies, gliders, possums. You know, the gorgeous, cute, furry creatures that Australia is known for, and these creatures are dying in the path of this.
That is absolutely staggering, Bianca. You just used the figure a billion animals. Yes. That have been impacted by this, either dead or injured. And certainly we all associate, you know, the koalas and the kangaroos with Australia because they are so strongly associated with the country. Are we looking at potential extinction here, or what are the implications of that?
They're severe. They're very serious implications. And it's worth pointing out as well that these fires come on top of another record-breaking period of drought. We're having our country is known as droughts and flooding rains, but this drought has been particularly severe. So these are ecosystems that are already struggling to survive, and to have a fire come through on the top of that. And the koala is a particularly vulnerable species because it has suffered a lot through habitat loss. It's threatened by disease. And, these populations, they're very slow moving. A koala, it's kind of like our version of a sloth. It just doesn't really move very fast. And so they cannot get away from these fires. So I think it's, without question, we are looking at some major iconic Australian species, not to mention a host of species that are, you know, less well known, that will be pushed to the brink of extinction. And I mean, you know, the best we can hope is that it's only to the brink, but I suspect that there will be ecosystems, that there will be, you know, species that will be pushed beyond that.
That is just stunning. You mentioned just a moment ago the drought, and I was reading about towns actually running out of drinking water. Tell us about that. And also, obviously, that's a factor. What kicked all of this off to begin with?
Well, it's always difficult because fires are such complex systems. I mean, we are currently experiencing certain kind of meteorological events. So we have in Australia what's called the Indian Ocean Dipole, which is a massive shift in warm water in the Indian Ocean, which, is a periodic kind of cyclic thing. But that's been in action. That's played a role in this drought. And the Indian Ocean Dipole is forecast to become more extreme with climate change. There are also other events like the El Nino Southern Oscillation Index that impacts the amount of rainfall in Australia. And there is sort of, you know, it's very complex to understand how all of these things fit together. But obviously there's a lot of research going on. There's a huge misinformation campaign going on that's trying to blame these fires on arson as a way to detract or to shift the focus away from climate change. Arson has, as far as we know, not caused any of the fires in Victoria. And there's only been 24 arrests for arson in New South Wales. So really these fires are often just caused by lightning strikes. They're caused by accidents. But whatever causes them, they're running as hot and fast and as long as they are because we have such dry bush, we have so little water. I mean, in many cases, firefighters are running out of water even to fight fires. You know, in Blackheath, they were lifting out from water from the bunkers in the golf course and from backyard pools. And so out west where the drought is crippling, and as you said, you know, we have towns where there are tens of thousands of people that are forecast to run out of water. In some cases, they're being supplied with bottled water to keep the town going. To kind of add insult to injury, you know, there are parts of Queensland where towns are running out of water, and yet we have an approval for a coal mine that's supposed to be drawing billions of litres of groundwater. So we have this drought against a backdrop of, you know, approvals for, you know, companies to mine water, both for you know, traditional mining, but also literally to sell bottled water. I mean, it's the height of incomprehension that these things could be going on alongside each other. But the implications for the survival of these towns is pretty severe.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. It sounds like there will be a great deal, if there hasn't been already, of finger pointing as it relates to the fossil fuel industry and all the coal production there.
Absolutely. I mean, fingers have been pointed at the fossil fuel industry in Australia for a very, very long time. But unfortunately, we have a government that is enslaved to that industry and enslaved to the mining industry, which has meant that we've had no action on climate, despite what the Australian government has said at the kind of climate summits. And I mean, we, you know, Australia was actually one of the first to introduce a carbon emissions trading scheme back in, I think it was in 2012. And it was very successful and our carbon emissions dropped. That was under Prime Minister Julia Gillard. But then unfortunately, when Tony Abbott got into power, he actually reversed that. And I think we've still have the kind of dubious distinction of being one of the only countries in the world to actually reverse a carbon emissions trading scheme. So we had the chance. We had the chance to make a difference, and we blew it. And unfortunately, since then, we've had successive governments who have waged a campaign of climate denial, which has meant that we've had very little action for a country whose per capita emissions are one of the highest in the world, particularly when you factor in our coal exports. It's a very sad state of affairs. And as awful as these fires are, I think there is a sense that perhaps things can't go back to the way they were after this. I certainly hope so, because these are just so catastrophic. They really give us a taste of what we are in for as a country if we do not take drastic action.
Well, speaking of not going back, you wrote a piece for The Atlantic recently with a provocative title, How Long Will Australia Be Livable? And in that piece, you talked about the sort of fighting spirit of the Australian people, you know, the desire to stick around and battle it out. But you also said that Australia is now faced with the prospect of considering something of a strategic retreat, something that you compared to events back in World War I. In our last minute and a half, what did you mean by that? And what might that strategic retreat look like?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I think that there's going to be a lot of discussion about what that might look like. But essentially, I mean, if we have towns and particularly agricultural endeavours that just cannot survive because there's no water or because they have been burned again and again and again, at some point the question needs to be asked, how long do we keep fighting this, what is effectively a losing battle and will be an even more spectacular loss if climate change action isn't taken, if we don't sort of turn this ship around. And it's a difficult prospect. I mean, I built a house 3 years ago. I'm in a very fire-prone area, but it's a beautiful area. And even this close call, you know, it's not entered my mind that we should leave. So I'm a symptom of the problem. But, you know, having said that, if we'd lost our house, you know, every few years our house got burned, I might rethink that. And I suspect that there will be people who are going to make decisions about where they retire to or where they build. They will be making those decisions with climate change in mind, with a view to the fact that because of either sea level rise or water shortages or bushfires, that this place that they love and that they have built their home may not be safe for them to live in anymore.
Mm. Bianca Nogrete, we are so grateful that you and your family and that your home are fine. And we want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us here on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Bianca Nogrete is a science reporter whose work has been featured in numerous publications, including Nature and Scientific American. Stay with us. There's much more on the Australian fires and what they mean for the rest of the world when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. The bushfires that have been consuming Australia for 4 months now are taking an unimaginable toll. 41,000 square miles of land have been scorched, something like 1,800 homes destroyed. The human death toll, 26 and climbing. The animal death toll is estimated to top out around a billion, and it is not a problem that's limited to Australia. The smoke from those fires can now be seen as far away as South America, and the flames have reignited the longstanding debate over global climate change and how countries need to respond. To help us understand what Australia's wildfires mean for the rest of the world, we turn to a couple of environmental journalists who write extensively on these topics. Elizabeth Colbert is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, among other books. She's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999 and has won numerous awards for her work. And Ed Struzik is a fellow at the Institute of Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada, and the author of Firestorm, How Wildfires Will Shape Our Future. We'd love for you to weigh in on this conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Elizabeth Colbert and Ed Struzik, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
So, thank you.
Elizabeth, I'll begin with you. I'd like to continue to some degree the conversation that we started with Bianca Nogrady just a few minutes ago. We didn't have a lot of time to get into the discussion of the heat waves that Australia's been experiencing, but 2019 was the hottest year on record there, as I understand it, and clearly those, you know, triple-digit temperatures have played a big role in what's happening now. And I'm wondering, is Australia particularly or uniquely vulnerable to climate change because of its hot, dry summers?
Well, I don't think anyone would say it's uniquely vulnerable, but it certainly is a vulnerable part of the world. I think one of the lessons that we're learning is there are many parts of the world that are vulnerable. We've seen fires, now consume vast areas of California. We saw tremendous wildfires this year in Siberia. We're now starting to see fires fairly regularly above the Arctic Circle. So I don't think there's one of the lessons of climate change, why it's called global warming. It truly is global, and I don't think there's any part of the world that's immune. Now, that being said, Australia is a dry, hot part of the world, always has been. Much of the country has always been on the edge of, habitability, at least as far as farming and arable land. It's just very, very dry. And when you ratchet up the temperature, you get more evaporation. And so places that I was actually recently in Australia a couple months ago, and people were talking about not having seen rain that actually, reached the earth before evaporating for a year. So that gives you a sense of how arid a lot of Australia is. Mm.
And Ed Struzik, I want to talk to you about the drought. Bianca talked about that, and towns literally running out of water between the heat and the lack of rainfall. Can the places that are hardest hit like that come back if something doesn't change?
They can come back, but they can come back a lot more slowly. That's the big problem. And I think, what we're going to be seeing over the long term is kind of like the Dust Bowl mentality, is that people will just give up on those places because they've just been so ravaged. Fire does a lot of things along with drought. If they burn really intensely, they can burn all of the nutrients out of the soil. And so forests may not come back, maybe not good for agriculture. There are so many implications associated with long-term drought combined with fire activity. And what we're seeing right now is, I have to say, I've been communicating a lot with fire scientists, and everybody saw this coming, but all of them just, it's just so head spinning that it's really hard for them to compute just how quickly this is all transpiring. And the models, I think, are just changing almost weekly now because of unforeseen circumstances. I kind of related to the melting of Arctic sea ice, is that everyone saw that coming, but no one saw that it was going to happen as quickly as it did.
Speaking of head spinning, Elizabeth Colbert, I am just stunned by the animal death toll here. We heard Bianca and others say that it could top out at a billion, or the injury and death toll. Is that an accurate number? And how do scientists come up with that kind of a number?
Well, that number is really just an extrapolation. I mean, people had done estimates of the density of animals in New South Wales. I believe this estimate was restricted to New South Wales, and it just sort of extrapolated out. If you think you have, you know, this many animals per hectare, per acre, and this is the number of acres that have been burned, so that's how they got to that number. I think people think it's a, you know, I was reading today some people saying it's perhaps conservative. I mean, of course, it also depends on, you know, if you're looking at animals, if you're looking at insects, we're talking about, you know, potentially phenomenal numbers. If you're looking at large mammals, obviously that's a different number. But we've all seen by now, I believe, those really horrific photos of charred, you know, kangaroos. So I think that the death toll is clearly very high. And then you get into the question, you know, the implications, as Ed was noting, once you have, even if you have animals that have survived, perhaps in burrows underground, when they come out, if they have nothing to eat, then, you know, they're going to add to the death toll.
There are also reports, Ed, that Australian hunters are now boarding helicopters and killing off camels from the air because they're complicating efforts to ease the drought. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, these are these kinds of extreme measures that everybody takes when it's too late to really do anything about it. And we're not immune to that kind of thing here in North America. Look what California is doing is they've run out of answers, and now they're rushing to clear-cut and thin forests without really truly understanding what the implications are. I mean, it may not be wrong, but we're in the situation now where we just are responding in extreme ways where we don't think these things through. And it may be, in these cases, the right answer, but we're left with, you know, kind of shooting from the hip at a target that is constantly moving, and I think that this is just leading to a lot of chaos and a lot of bad decision-making. Mm.
You just mentioned thinning out forests, and I've been reading some articles about, you know, backburning versus controlled burning. Can you explain what the difference is? And I know that there is some controversy around both of those.
Well, backburning is something that firefighters do to stop a fire. Essentially, they burn off of an area in front of the fire front, and when the fire hits that burned area, it essentially stops, and it's very effective in many cases. I saw the example happening in Kootenay National Park, which borders Banff National Park in Canada, in 2003. And the firefighters in that case did a backburn that really didn't follow the rules, but they had really no choice. If they hadn't done that backburn, it would have gone right into Banff National Park, where you've got a 80 to 120-year-old forest, and it would have gone all the way to the town site. It would have been a disaster. Mm. Controlled burning is something that they tend to do in the springtime and the fall when the conditions are a little bit wetter, and trying to mimic what Mother Nature would do in the case of, say, lightning strikes. National parks are really have this problem because they were so effective at fighting fires for the longest time, lightning-triggered fires, for example, for the longest time, that they created the stands of forests that are 80 to 120 years old. Many of these forests have been extremely vulnerable to mountain pine beetles. And so this idea is really to try to mimic what's happening, what would have happened in the past. And the science is solid in some cases, but again, it's an extreme measure that we've taken because we really haven't come to learn how to live with fire in not only here in North America, but around the world.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the bushfires in Australia. They have been burning for 4 months now. The toll is just unimaginable. And we are talking with Elizabeth Colbert. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sixth Extinction. She's also been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. And Ed Struzik is a fellow at the Institute of Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. Elizabeth Colbert, I mentioned that there's some controversy around all of this, and part of it is the media's role in promoting information or misinformation, depending on sort of where you stand on this. But Rupert Murdoch's media outlets and others have been, according to reports, advancing narratives that environmentalists oppose some of these measures like backburning that Ed just described to prevent the spread of fires, and condemning protesters for being too radical about climate change, or even, you know, pushing the idea that it's really arson that's to blame here. What is that all about?
Well, I'm not an Australian, and, you know, I don't read The Australian, which is sort of the big Murdoch paper in Australia. But when I was in Australia a couple months ago, I was somewhat shocked to read the coverage of all sorts of environmental issues in that newspaper. It's a kind of classic Murdochian approach that we all now should be familiar with from Fox News, where you just take, you know, a pretty fringy position on scientific issues and push it out front. And I think that if anything good comes from these fires, which, you know, it's hard to see exactly, but it could be that some people in Australia, you know, wake up to this disinformation campaign. I think that Australia is very much like the U.S. in a lot of ways. The media landscape is not that different. The political landscape is not that different. But it's sort of an extreme case because they're seeing the effects of climate change more dramatically than we are right now, even more dramatically. And they have their heads in the proverbial sand, perhaps, you know, sort of just as dramatically. And Australia makes a lot of its income, I don't know the proportion of its income, but on extractive industries. So mines, you will be in the middle of nowhere. I was in the middle of the outback, for example. There was nothing around, but on the horizon you could see this enormous mine, really the size of a city, at night, lit up. Australia has a lot of mineral resources that are being extracted. It has a lot of coal that's being extracted. Their economy is very much tied up, you know, once again, as is the U.S. The U.S. is now, you know, once again, a huge oil producer, a huge natural gas producer. Coal is somewhat on the wane, but we have also a very large fossil fuel industry. They're economically and politically extremely powerful, and that's the situation that we're in right now. We're in this sort of, you could argue, absurd fight over the facts, because they're not convenient for a lot of people in those industries, but they are simply the facts. You know, you burn fossil fuels, you put CO2 into the air. CO2 is a greenhouse gas. The world is getting warmer, and we absolutely need to get past this absurd argument and start talking about what we're going to do about all this. And I think Australians, I hope, realize that is the case. Now, they then turn around and say, which is also true, they're very high per capita emitters, as are we in the U.S. They're a much smaller country. They have much fewer people. They're a large country, but they just don't have that many people. So their contributions to aggregate greenhouse gas emissions are on the order of like 1.5%. So they're fairly low, and Australia on its own is not going to solve the problem. So then you get into this swirl, once again, that we've been in on the international level for many, many years, where everyone points the finger at someone else and says, well, if we do something, it's not going to matter because they're not doing something. And the fact is that everyone needs to do something.
Ed Struck, you have literally written the book on firestorms, and that is one of the big concerns that has come out in Australia. And that may be a fairly new concept to some people, but we're hearing a lot more about that in light of what's been happening there. What exactly are firestorms, and how dangerous are they to the environment, not just in Australia, but in other places where we're seeing these kinds of huge fires?
Well, I mean, it's a word that's not clearly got a definition, but I would describe it as things that are happening in the fire regime that We rarely see. The Canberra fire in Australia in 2003, for example, produced a F2 tornado with black hail, and it was equivalent to 22 kilotons of TNT, which was more than Hiroshima. And then you had the Horse River fire in Alberta in 2016, which was right adjacent to the tar sands. And that fire burned so hot, it created its own thunderstorm, what they call a pyro CB. And it ignited a cluster of fires more than 20 miles from the fire front. And if you can imagine that, it's a blue sky day. There's a high pressure system over this entire area. And then suddenly you're getting ignition 20 miles away from the fire front. None of the firefighters, none of the wildfire scientists that I've talked to have ever seen anything like that. And I'll give you a third example. In 2015, a slow-moving thunderstorm in Alaska shot out 62,000 lightning strikes in just 5 days and triggered 286 fires. Mm-hmm. No one had ever seen anything like that. We're now seeing these pyro CB events spreading right around the world. There's several of them in Australia. I'm tied into an internet group that has been tracking them, and you'd think you'd see maybe one or two in a year, and they're seeing multiple examples of this. In British Columbia and Washington, a couple of years ago, there were four in a period of just 5 hours. So we're starting to see things happening in fire regimes that we rarely saw before, and I think these are more strong signals that or harbingers of what's to come, and it's extremely worrisome, because how do you deal with fire events like that?
So we've got just about 45 seconds to go before the break here, Ed, but I do want to follow up on that, because it sounds like, you know, you've got these fires that then beget more fires because of these clouds that rise up. What about the chemicals that are contained in that, and sort of what's the long term of something like that?
Well, you know, if you think about it, there's the chemicals in smoke from a fire are pretty much the same as they are from cigarette smoke, and we're constantly breathing them in. But they also shoot other things out, such as asbestos needles. In Libby and Montana, they have a serious problem there. They've got FEMA there, I think, all summer long to deal with the fire, because if that forest burns in the Kootenay Forest, those asbestos needles will not combust. They'll just go up with the plume, and they'll fall down on people around them. And we know that plumes can travel across the world. So there's real concern. At one point, the firefighters, U.S. Forest firefighters, refused to or promised that they would not fight a fire near Libby.
I'm going to stop you right there, Ed, because we have to take a quick break. Hold that thought. Radio Times will be right back. Welcome.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. If you're just joining us, we are talking about those bushfires that have been raging out of control in Australia since September, fueled by drought and extremely high temperatures and high winds. And the tolls have been staggering. Something like 41,000 square miles of land that has been scorched. More than two dozen people have died. Scientists are now predicting that the animal death toll could approach a billion by the time all of this is over. So just absolutely staggering what's been happening in Australia. We have been talking with a couple of environmental journalists to better understand not only what's happening there, but what are the implications and the lessons for the rest of the world. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert. She is a New Yorker staff writer and author of a number of books, including Field Notes from a Catastrophe and The Sixth Extinction. We're also talking with Ed Struzik. He is a fellow at the Institute of Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He's also the author of Firestorm, How Wildfires Will Shape our future. We invite you to weigh in on the conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Ed Struzik, just before we went into the break, you were explaining what pyro-CBs are, talking about these firestorms, these clouds that sort of create their own weather systems and create lightning that sparks more fires and the effects of that. And you were talking about even asbestos in some of them. I'd like you to sort of finish that thought before we move on.
Yeah, we've, you know, in the case of Libby, Montana, there was an asbestos mine that operated there for nearly a century, and the EPA, I think, spent about a $700 million in Superfund money to clean it up. And when they thought they had it all done, there was a study done by public health officials to look at whether or not that asbestos, how far it had spread, and whether it got into the bark of the trees, because everybody in Libby heats their homes and cooks with wood that they harvest from the Kootenai Forest. And when they did the analysis, they found asbestos needles within the bark. And then when they did some plume tests where they actually burned it to see whether or not the asbestos would essentially disintegrate, they found that it didn't. It went up with that plume. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing examples of this that we haven't really explored thoughtfully or meaningfully, such as around arsenic mines. The giant mine in Yellowknife in northern Canada that produced the biggest arsenic pile ever, but they're finding arsenic in tree bark as well. So these are areas that we really haven't explored. And I can tell you there are some government scientists that don't want to explore it because they have such big headaches now that they just don't want to find another big challenge that they don't know how to deal with or they don't have funds to deal with.
That is incredible. Elizabeth Colbert, we were talking earlier, I mentioned earlier that I had read that smoke from these fires in Australia can be seen in Argentina, which is 7,000 miles away. Can you talk about that? How it is that the smoke can be seen 7,000 miles away, and then what are the implications for South America?
Well, you see these incredible, you know, satellite images which show how much smoke these fires are emitting, and then, you know, that given that the prevailing winds are taking them across the Pacific to South America, it's really not a surprise. You know, when there are tremendous fires in Indonesia, for example, people, you know, the effects are seen in the Pacific Northwest and California. So that is, you know, a common, unfortunately, very sad side effect that the smoke travels a very, very long distance. Now, what the impacts are going to be in South America, I would suspect that they're not very great. I mean, that we're seeing the real impacts are focused in Australia, but most of the fires are concentrated on the east coast of Australia. So that smoke is not blowing across Australia, it's blowing away from Australia. Mm.
Is it something that we could potentially see in North America or could be seen in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, they're pretty far south, Australia. I think it's fairly, you know, I'm not a meteorologist. Probably my speculation is not worth that much, but I don't think we would expect it to sort of drift across the equator and up to the Northern Hemisphere.
Ed Struzik, we were talking about, you know, ecosystems being in danger in Australia, entire ecosystems. And I wonder, can they regenerate themselves after something as catastrophic as this? And then what is the role of human beings in sort of helping to encourage that recovery? How might that work?
Well, I think we can look at it two ways. One is that, you know, fire is a natural process that regenerates forests, especially a boreal forest that you have in the northern part of the United States and throughout Canada and the Scandinavian world and Siberia. And so that actually is a good thing when you have fire because, to some extent, those trees, those spruce and pines, have a shelf life of between 80 to 100 years. And after 80 years, they become increasingly vulnerable to disease. So fire fire, to some extent, is very necessary. But where we're beginning to see on the landscape is fires burning so hot, as I said earlier, that they essentially destroy the nutrients in the soil. And so the trees can't go back. There's no seeds there. There's not enough nutrition in the soil for them to grow back. And I think we're seeing examples of that. It's not widespread. And so I think we've got to be able to deal with this. The one good thing about North America, and people tend to roll their eyes when I talk about it, but it's very important, is that we have a system of wetlands across this country in which most wildlife can escape to during a fire, and they do. Studies have been done to show that caribou, grizzly bears, black bears, and other animals will immediately go to a fen or a bog or a marsh or a wetland, and they can get out of harm's way. You can't do that in many parts of Australia because it's just uniformly dry. So the problem is that we are now draining those wetlands at a rapid rate. You look at the tar sands in Canada, for example, I think has eliminated about 750 square miles of wetland. And we're doing this all over. It's just not the tar sands, but municipalities are doing it. Forestry companies are doing it to some extent. And so we're destroying these refuges. And I think that that's one line of attack that can make us, at least from an environmental point of view, more resilient to what we're going to see in the future, is start protecting these wetlands.
Mm. You know, we've been talking about the animal death toll, the human death toll, the scorched land, these ecosystems. What about the Great Barrier Reef? How might that be impacted by all of this? And I'm asking Ed.
I think that, I don't know enough about it, but I do know that, for example, probably a better example on the impact on water quality is what's happening in our rivers here in North America following extreme fires, is that you have a lot of carbon that ends up in those water systems, and they tend to clog up our filtration systems for drinking water quality. Mm-hmm. And so places like Fort McMurray now are spending 3 to 4 times more than they spent on water treatment. Denver, their water treatment plants nearly got knocked out because of fires there. Canberra, Australia. So I think, the Great Barrier Reef is vulnerable in similar ways, but in ways that I'm just don't qualify to be able to talk about.
Elizabeth Colbert, I want to sort of widen the lens here and talk a little bit about what is happening elsewhere. We're very much focused on Australia for obvious reasons, but you've mentioned some other places as well. And, just thinking about the Arctic Ocean, some things that have happened in Japan and India, can you sort of identify some of those for us and what is happening in other places in the world that are testament to the problems that we're seeing now with climate change?
Well, we just got the figures for 2019, which has been tallied up to be the second warmest year on record, and it joined all of the last 5 years are among the hottest 5 on record. So, if that's not powerful evidence that we are in a warming trend, I don't know what would be. Now, what really, so what you look at when you look at these aggregate global temperatures or global averages, but what really is very devastating and has been devastating in Australia, has been devastating in a lot of parts of the world, are these temperature extremes that we're now seeing. So we set heat records this past summer, were set in France, they were set in Germany, they were set in, as you say, there was a terrible heat wave in Japan. It sent something like 18,000 people to the hospital. It killed several dozen. There was heat wave in India that killed many people and sent many people to the hospital. So we're seeing at these temperature extremes, when we get these extreme events, heat waves, which we've always gotten, but now, heat waves are getting hotter, they're getting more intense. They have actually, we're reaching the point where we're at sort of in some parts of the world, the limits of what human physiology can deal with, and people are going to start to look at that. There are parts of the world, parts of the Middle East, parts of India that are very hot naturally, and you ratchet up the temperature and put a heat wave on top of that, and you are really, really getting to the extremes of the tolerance of the human body. So that is something that lies, you know, a huge humanitarian problem that doesn't just lie in the future, but is actually happening right now. And to get back to a point that Ed made, that people are, you know, seeing impacts that they always expected from climate change. You know, you yank up the thermostat of the planet, you're going to see big impacts, and models predicted, you know, virtually everything that we're seeing. The scary thing is that we're actually seeing some impacts, many impacts, sooner than the models expected. So, you know, in this whole world of climate, you know, quote unquote debate, and I use that term advisedly, where some people would argue, well, you know, we're not seeing things that the models are not accurate. Actually, to the extent that the models are not accurate, in a lot of cases, it's because they are not dire enough.
Hmm. Elizabeth, how much time do we have here? I mean, before we hit the point of no return, how much time do we have to act to try to mitigate some of this?
Well, I think that the important point to make about climate change, and that's why climate scientists have been warning us about this really for 50 years now, is that the system has a lot of inertia to it. It's not that you can say, oh, well, we've suddenly woken up in 2019, we don't like the climate we have right now, and we'd like to turn it around. Even that is not possible in a short term. The problem is also that we are adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere at a tremendous rate. Another record was hit in 2019, we're up to 43 billion metric tons of CO2 that we're adding to the atmosphere. And every increment of CO2 translates into an increment of temperature increase. So if we wanted to deal with this in a serious way, we would still say are going to be seeing these effects for decades, centuries, potentially millennia, but we would have to reduce our emissions really, really dramatically and quite, quite quickly. Because if you reduce your emissions, let's say we were to reduce our emissions by half, we would still get to the same amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It would just take us twice as long. So we really have to reduce them down to zero. That is a big, big reduction from 43 billion metric tons per year. But unfortunately, that is the challenge that we're facing.
Mm. Which leads to a question about the Paris Climate Accord. Can you remind us sort of where are we with that? And is it going to have to be renegotiated, or what is the status?
Well, the Paris Climate Accord was negotiated in 2015. It was an attempt to sort of break this stalemate, this international logjam, which gets back to this idea that everyone was saying, well, you know, you first, and a big separation between the developed countries of the world, like the U.S., like the EU, which historically were the big emitters, and the developing countries saying, well, you know, you guys have already basically eaten all the pie, and now you're telling us, oh, you know, we can't have any, and that's not really fair. And there's a very, very strong argument to be made there. So these arguments have been going on for many, many years. The Paris Accord basically was an attempt to really paper over a lot of that and just say, look, everyone come to the table with what your country is willing to commit to do. And a big part of that also was there was going to be money that was going to be made available, a sort of green climate fund from the developed world to the developing world, and the U.S. committed, you know, billions of dollars to that, not a very large amount on the scale of, you know, global commitments, but a significant chunk of money. And then the Trump administration came in and basically said, we're out of Paris, we're reneging on all that. It's trying to roll back the regulations that would have that were the underpinning of the U.S.'s commitment. These were fuel efficiency standards and power plant standards. So when people met in Madrid, negotiators met in Madrid a month ago, there was yet another basically a stalemate. And the U.S. and Australia, ironically enough, were among the countries, the two of the big stalemate causers, as it were. So Paris is extant some countries are definitely seriously pursuing and trying to fulfill their commitments, and I think that's particularly true in EU countries. But a lot of the world is just, you know, twiddling its thumbs, and that definitely includes the U.S.
Mm. Well, it is just about time for me to say goodbye, but I do want to thank both of you for being with us and helping us to navigate these issues, to understand what is happening in Australia and what it means for the rest of the world. We've been talking with Elizabeth Colbert. She is a New Yorker staff writer. We are also talking with Ed Struzik, a fellow at the Institute of Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. Many thanks to both of you for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank our producers. They have been Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen, and our engineer, of course, has been Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM.